if we're honest, we will look into the mirror and see what the truth is. And see what the truth is. And see what the truth is.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised.
It will be podcast.
Welcome to the No Illusions Podcast, recorded Thursday, 29th of September, 2011. My name's Cameron Riley. You're on the podcast network. This is the show where we keep it real. Yo. That's my impersonation of Jesse from Breaking Bad. This is the show where I talk about the news that probably didn't get a lot of coverage in the mainstream media over the last week or so. A lot of religion, some politics, some society. Obviously need more coffee. Some social issues. We try and figure out on this show what's really going on. How does the world really work? Who's holding the keys? Who's pulling the strings? Can you believe what you're being told by the people in control, by the people in power? And how do we build a more sustainable world? And I don't mean just environmentally, but I mean how do we all not kill each other? How do we build a world where my children and their children are likely to be safe, healthy, well-fed, etc. So, first of all, I'd like to say a shout-out to long-time listener, supporter of the show and of the network, Tony Kynaston. Tony and his lovely wife, Jennifer, took us out to dinner last night. Chrissy and myself went to a lovely restaurant here in Brisbane. They were visiting up from Melbourne. And as always, we had a really good conversation, covered lots of stuff, religion, politics, ethics, and it's really nice to have met people through the show that you then get to spend time with in real life and have intelligent conversations, good times with.
The governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world. The governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world. The governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world. Goldman Sachs does not care about this rescue package, neither does the big funds. Goldman Sachs does not care about this rescue package, neither does the big funds. The governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world. The governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world. The governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world.
Well, it started raining in Brisbane, as you could probably hear on the outside. So that was a trader from London on the BBC. Well, he's not a trader on the BBC. He was being interviewed by the BBC recently. You've probably seen that clip. His name is Alessio Rastani. And, you know, there's been that video's gone viral, and there's a lot of people saying, well, this guy's a nobody. He's apparently an independent trader who trains out of his girlfriend's apartment. But I think he eloquently said what a lot of people have come to believe. Governments don't rule the world. Goldman Sachs rules the world. Just a good clip. You can expect to see that sort of auto-tuned and mashed up at some stage in the not-too-distant future, I imagine, with a beat behind it. Now, I want to cover something else here. Give me a second to bring up an article by Stuart Wallace. Now, if you haven't heard of Stuart Wallace and you don't follow the New Economic Forum, neweconomics.org, or follow them on Twitter, The New Economics, I highly recommend it. Stuart is an interesting character. He's got a background at the World Bank, a business degree in economics from a Masters of Business and Economics at London's Business School. Traditional sort of economics business background. But he runs this thing called the New Economics Forum, and he wrote this interesting article just a couple of days ago called A Great Transition. And it's always interesting to me when I see these sorts of stories written by people who aren't on the left or the new left. They're pro-market, pro-capitalist forces, traditional business and economics backgrounds that have come to the realization, as have many of us, that the way that we're running our economies in the West is unsustainable. He starts off by referring to E.F. Schumacher, the author of a classic book from the late 60s, I think, Small is Beautiful. got a copy of it at home somewhere. Anyway, I'm just going to read some excerpts from this article. I won't read the whole thing, but hopefully you find it interesting. It says, Fritz Schumacher was unequivocal about the evils of modern industrial society, whether capitalist, socialist, or communist. He thought it guilty of four great and grievous evils. One, its vastly complicated nature. Two, its continuous simulation of and reliance on the deadly sins of greed, envy, and avarice. Three, its destruction of the content and dignity of most forms of work. And four, its authoritarian character owing to organization in excessively large units. He went on to say that modern industrial society should fail because, inter alia, it was depleting and polluting the earth's resources, degrading human moral and intellectual qualities, and breeding violence, a violence against nature which, at any time, could turn into violence against fellow humans. I want to show today how true his insights were and why we are now in a situation where we face a number of systemic and interlinked crises of unimaginable proportions. And he goes on in the next section, which I'll skip, talking about, four systemic interlinked crises. So he says it's unsustainable, it's unfair, it's unstable, and it leads to unhappiness. I want to get to the next section. This is the main quote I wanted to share with you. This section is called The Underlying Causes. I believe that much of economics, as it is now taught and practiced, is both intellectually and morally bankrupt. There's a strong statement, that's a strong statement for me to make, but I think this is much truer for economics than for many other disciplines. So much of what we base our thinking on are old myths and half-truths in addition to some new myths that have developed. There are three pervasive economic myths that have been around for a long time. Now, this is an interesting section. Sorry, this is me breaking away here. Because when you get into discussions about politics or economics with your typical CWM, conservative white male, you often hear this really deep belief in the fairness and the power. Oh, the rain stopped and I've changed microphones. It's getting buzzing. Anyway, long story. And the intrinsic, superiority of the laissez-faire capitalism. So anyway, and it's often based on this idea of the invisible hand of the markets. And here's what Stuart Wallace has to say. I believe that there are three pervasive economic myths that have been around for a long time. The first is that markets are fair. Markets do not provide the right outcomes for the benefit of the most people. Sometimes this myth is linked to the idea of the invisible hand. Well, Adam Smith did mention that invisible hand once in The Wealth of Nations when he was talking about a bakery. But the situation on which he predicated it was that there were large numbers of buyers and sellers, none of whom could influence the price, and furthermore that those actors were behaving in a moral way. Now, neither of these assumptions applies. We see huge concentrations of power in many markets. There are four or five companies that control 80 to 90% of the world grain market. The same is true for numerous other markets. And look at the purchasing side. Do people have equal purchasing rights? No, they don't. The richest 1% of the people in the world earn as much as the poorest 57%. That doesn't come close to resembling a level playing field. What happens to markets where power balances aren't equal? Well, it's fairly simple. If you go into a market with more power than the other players, you don't end up with the same amount of power, but rather with even more power. The idea of self-leveling simply doesn't apply. We need to remember that Adam Smith also wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiment, in which he argued that markets work only if the actors are moral, and of course, they're not. So when we think about Adam Smith and laissez-faire capitalism, the invisible hand, the power of the markets, we need to remember that that only works if the power balance is equal and if the actors in the market are moral. So it just doesn't apply to everyday situations in Western developed societies, which is why we end up with the situation we have today with incredible inequality in the marketplace and all of the corruption and the problems that breeds. In the last section, Wallace goes on to describe his vision for the new economics. We need an economy which has as its main goal to improve human needs, not wants. And let me repeat that because I think that's powerful. main goal is to improve human needs, not wants, which is, of course, what modern advertising does. It tells us we want more and more and more and more, and has us running after the latest stuff and continually chasing our tail. This economy needs to create and support sufficient good jobs and good work, and to do so in a way that is much more equitable, both between peoples alive now and between current and future generations. It needs to be an economy that recognizes that it is but a subset of the ecosystem, and which therefore works within planetary limits. Perhaps above all, though, it needs to be an economy constructed with a biocentric view of the world, not an anthropocentric one. We need to move from being consumers to stewards. Such an economy must also factor in the spiritual, the aesthetic, and the symbolic. So, I'll just finish off with the last section here. He says, we at NEF, it's a New Economic Forum, can provide much of the what needs doing, but we cannot make it a reality on our own. There's a fearsome responsibility resting on all of us that have been inspired by Fritz Schumacher's work and life. We cannot say we did not understand. His insights, 100 years after his birth, are like a lighthouse illuminating the path forward. We need to draw on his wisdom and courage and together follow this path. So maybe that's a book we should all go and reread. E.F. Schumacher, Small is Beautiful. I have to try and find it for the iPad. I want to jump now to a clip from Elizabeth Warren. Now, if you haven't seen or heard of her before, she's an American. She's an American attorney, law professor, and currently United States Senate candidate. She served as assistant to the president and special advisor to the Secretary of the Treasury for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. In the wake of the financial crisis, she became the chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel created to oversee the TARP, U.S. banking bailout. But she's a very, very articulate lady. And here's something that there's a video on YouTube of her in a house full of people giving like a bit of a campaigning speech. And she talks about the suggestion that taxing the rich is a form of class warfare. Here's what she has to say.
I hear all this, this is class warfare, this is whatever. No, there is nobody in this country who got rich on his own. Nobody. You built a factory out there, good for you, but I want to be clear, you moved your goods to market on the roads the rest of us paid for. Yep. You hired workers the rest of us paid to educate. You were safe in your factory because of police forces and fire forces that the rest of us paid for. You didn't have to worry that marauding bands would come and seize everything at your factory and hire someone to protect against this because of the work the rest of us did. Now look, you built a factory and it turned into something terrific or a great idea. God bless. Keep a big hunk of it. But part of the underlying social contract is you take a hunk of that and pay forward for the next kid who comes along.
So there you have Elizabeth Warren saying that far more eloquently than I ever could. You know, it's the same argument, though, that I've tried to have with conservative white males on a regular basis. You know, you really can't take 100% of the credit for your success when you live in a society where you were supported by millions of other people. As Elizabeth said, you know, it doesn't matter how brilliant or hardworking you have been, which you should get credit for, but if you live in a society where you have somebody who works in a petrol station so you have petrol for your car and your employees have petrol for their cars, you have somebody who's cleaning up the garbage so you don't have to do it, you have somebody who's preparing your food so you don't have to do that. If you had to do all those things by yourself, you would spend all of your time just in survival mode, subsisting. You wouldn't have the luxury of the time to go and build your business. So this idea, which admittedly I had myself in my 20s when I was in the middle of my Ayn Rand period, that entrepreneurs somehow stand alone in society is just not true. You succeed in part because of the society that you live in. And therefore, you have a responsibility to contribute some of your success, some of your earnings back into that society as return on their investment in you, but also, as Elizabeth Warren points out, for future generations, for your children, for your children's children, you have to invest back into those fundamentals of society, be it infrastructure or just, you know, we need people out there doing the stuff that we don't want to do. This sort of comes down too to my general philosophy on asylum seekers, you know, boat people as they get called in Australia, people who try and enter the country for asylum purposes. Often, you know, we have a few thousand a year that travel by boat. That, you know, those people are valuable resources. If not them themselves, then their children who will get educated in the Australian education system. They'll be given the benefit of the Australian healthcare system, and they too will end up as productive members of society. Some of them might just be the people that are keeping the roads functioning or, you know, picking up the garbage. Some might become doctors and scientists that when you, Mr. Successful Entrepreneur, are in your 70s and 80s, they might be the ones that have an understanding of the latest medical technologies to keep you alive and your family alive. They might have the latest technological breakthroughs that make all of our lives better. So it's important for all of us to understand that we live in a society, and this whole idea that it's class warfare is ridiculous. You know, it gets back to this idea of ethics that I was talking with Tony about last night, Tony and his wife. You know, we don't have in this country any real sense of what our ethics or values are as a nation. We don't have a Bill of Rights. We have a finance minister in the government. We have an agriculture minister. We have an environment minister. We have a health minister. We don't have a minister for ethics. I'd really like to see an ethics ministry that determines whether or not the policies of the government of the day map against the ethics of the people as a whole, or of just the political party. What are the ethics that we stand for? How do we know that the policies that we're putting into place actually conform to our ethical standards as a people? Moving on to some science stories, while I'm mentioning science, interesting story about a digital brain that has been successfully tested in a rat. There were some scientists in Tel Aviv University in Israel that have built a synthetic cerebellum which can receive sensory inputs from the brainstem and transmit them back into the brain. Now, the cerebellum is the part of the brain that, among other things, helps coordinate and time movements. So it tells your brain what sort of actions you need to make with your limbs and your eyes, etc. What they did is they disabled the cerebellum in a rat. They anesthetized it, disabled its cerebellum, and then hooked it up to this chip, this digital cerebellum that they had built. Then they tried to teach the anesthetized rat a conditioned motor reflex, a blink, by combining an auditory tone with a puff of air on the eye until the animal blinked when it heard the same tone. So, you know, basically a Pavlovian response. Now, they tried this without the chip connected, and the rat couldn't learn the motor reflex. Then they turned the artificial cerebellum on, and the rat behaved like a normal animal would. It learnt the behavioural response. Now, obviously, it's a very simple experiment, but as a number of neuroscientists have said around the world, very exciting that these scientists have been able to actually artificially reproduce this part of the brain in the rat. They were actually able to map the entire brain function that the cerebellum is responsible for and digitize that. Now, of course, that still means we're a long way from having any sort of artificial brain extensions, but we're getting so close. Every year we're making massive progress in understanding how the brain works, and these scientists have been able to synthesize a very small portion of that on a small animal, and it's obviously a small reflex. It's not walking as a result of this. It's just learning how to blink when it hears a sound. But I think that's a very exciting piece of progress. And last story I wanted to touch on today, because we haven't done any religion in the show today, and you know I love doing religion. There was some sexual abuse that's been covered up and since uncovered in South Australia. Let me just bring up this story. This is covered on Four Corners Show on the ABC in Australia. It says, in July this year, authorities in South Australia decided not to proceed with a case claiming sexual abuse of a child with an intellectual disability. The prosecution formed the view that the child could not give reliable evidence. The accused was released. The parents were enraged. But Four Corners has discovered this full story of children and families from St. Anne's Special School in Adelaide. Speaking openly on television for the first time, parents whose children attended the school in the 80s and 90s tell stories of abuse which they say highlight the limitations of the legal system and the apparent incapacity of the church to openly confront these issues. In 1991, police searched the home of Brian Perkins, the bus driver from St. Anne's. They found photographs of several naked children who attended the school. Police moved to prosecute Perkins, but due to a systems error, he was given bail and absconded. But this wasn't the only mistake. Although they knew it was possible that up to 30 children had been abused, the police and the school authorities did not tell all the parents whose children had come into contact with Perkins. For 10 years, nothing was done. 10 years. Over that time, many of the children developed terrible behavioural problems. Finally, as a result of a chance encounter between the parents, the full extent of their children's abuse was revealed. The parents tell how, in the decade that followed their discovery, they struggled to get justice from the Catholic Church and the police. None of them can understand why the abuse was covered up or why church authorities have fought so hard, in spite of their offer of a one-off financial payment to some families, to avoid admitting the extent of the abuse. Now, you know, if you've listened to the show before, you know my stance on the Catholic Church. You know, the Catholic Church has a policy in place, it's been well documented, that enforces the senior management of the church, the bishops, the cardinals, all the way up to the Pope, protect and hide priests or employees of the church that are accused of sexual abuse. Now, there's been massive inquiries into child abuse in the Catholic Church in Ireland. There's a big case happening in Philadelphia that I mentioned on it with the interview with Father Bob earlier in the week. But, you know, in Australia, we just don't seem to have any political will on behalf of either the state or federal governments to do a genuine full inquiry of the extent of abuse. And it's not just child rape and child abuse, it's sexual abuse of adults inside of the church as well that have also suffered. In this country, it's just sort of a no-go zone for some reason for the politicians. And, you know, I did a show a couple of years ago with a support group for people that have been abused by the Catholic Church in this country. They estimated there are up to 30,000 victims in Australia alone. And yet the Catholic Church seems to keep going on with impunity. And again, it's not, as the Catholic Church would try and spin it, a case of a few bad eggs, or as some people try and tell me, well, you know, sexual abuse happens everywhere, child abuse happens everywhere, Catholic Church just gets too much attention. It's not about the statistics. What it's about is systematic cover-ups by the Catholic Church as a matter of policy, not bringing these cases to the police. You know, they have a policy of if there's a priest that's been accused of child abuse, they hush it all up and they just move that priest to another diocese and another congregation so he can do it all again. They don't take the case to the authorities to be investigated. They don't care about the victims. It's all about covering their asses, covering their reputation, and protecting their wealth. It's disgraceful, it's appalling, and we need to do something about it. Well, that's the show for today. Thanks for listening. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter, Cameron Riley. You can get me on email, cameron@thepodcastnetwork.com. Leave comments on the blog, noillusionspodcast.com. Love to get your feedback on the stories from today, suggestions for any stories we might do in the future. And I'll be back next week. This is Cameron out.
But if we're honest, we will look into the mirror and see what the truth is.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised.
It will be podcast.